Hello, this is Against Everyone with Connor Habib. Friends, continuing on with my series of episodes about work, I wanted to consider the work that I love the most, that's often the most exciting to me, which is the work of writing. I want to consider not just writing itself, as, you know, the craft of writing stories and novels, but being a writer. That is what writing takes and takes from you, that work of being a writer. It's different than just writing. And I wanted to do it with another working writer who writes in the genre-defying and genre-defining modes. So I asked Sarah Maria Griffin back onto the show. Sarah was last on episode 93 when we talked about dark fantasy, dark imagination, and then it was the first time I met Sarah. She came over to the house, and all the lights on the block went out as soon as we finished. So talk about dark. And then we did tarot readings for each other because she's also an excellent tarot reader, and we do a lot of tarot pop-up events on the Patreon. She's the author of poetry, zines, memoir, and dark fantasy novels, including her masterful weird novel, Other Words for Smoke. She has two upcoming horror novels, so please keep an eye out. I'm not allowed to announce all the details yet, but they're coming not too long from now. And she is also a teacher. She understands, therefore, the life of not just writing, but being a writer and all that requires, the mediating of the forces of dark and difficult realms. I mean it. The contending with the darkness of the imagination, but also the darkness of the economy and the political interactions of publishing in all different forms. She understands the frightening endurance that is required of writers, the tedious quotidian tasks, and the managing of the expectations of readers. We start off by talking about the questions that people ask at readings. Maybe you've heard these questions asked at readings, or maybe you've asked one of them yourself. Where do you get your ideas? Do you have any advice for young or new writers? What's your writing practice like? All these things that are trying to kind of get into the mystery that a lot of writers don't understand themselves and yet are, you know, forced to answer on the spot. Because it takes something to be a writer that's not just about writing. And a lot of that has to do with that gap between writers and readers. It's so weird. If you think about it, it's like when you write, you get this strange occurrence or presence of the imagination. A lot of times for me, as someone who writes horrific things, if I'm not writing nonfiction, if I'm writing fiction, it's kind of like I'm dwelling with the Hieronymus Bosch landscape. And I'm trying to turn that into something, into story, style, and plot. And when I do that, I have to do it not by painting, like I'm not creating a direct image for you to look at, or, you know, with film, but I'm doing that by putting symbols down on a page, and then I hand those symbols over to the world. Letters, sentences, punctuation, space. And I hope that whoever finds what I've done will be able to recompose it and bring their own individuality to it. It's really unlike any other art. There's overlap, of course, but it's just very different. It's not easy work. And then, of course, there are different stakes for different readers. The casual reader, the serious reader, the reader who is going to pay you by becoming your publisher, the reader is going to help you get paid by becoming your agent, the reviewers, so on and so forth. I love this work, and Sarah does too. It's actually what we love the most, this effort. And why? Why do we want more of that isolation, more of that ecotone of symbol and reality? This is a very personal and kind of weird episode. I'm very happy to share it with you. I hope it helps you think about your own artistic processes and work and what it means to do that work and all the intersecting forces that seem to interfere with or augment or help that creative, spiritual, cultural, artistic process. Against Everyone with Connor Habib exists because people support it on Patreon. I don't charge anything for any episodes, neither do any podcasters. That's something I talked about in one of the earlier episodes about work this year. The whole realm of podcasting is almost completely free. Millions of episodes just out there for free. And we don't get paid for this kind of work. And I don't want to get paid for my time, although it does take a lot of time to do each episode. I would love, however, if you feel connected to the show, that you support it, that you show that connection in whatever way you can. The preferred way for me always is, of course, Patreon, because it helps the show in a very direct way. Patreon.com/ConnorHabib. I would love to be someone that didn't need to say this at the top of the show, but usually the trade-off for that is people have ads. I don't like having ads. I like having real connection. And I don't like being paid for labor. I like being encouraged in my presence in the world. So patreon.com/ConnorHabib is a great way to support the show. You can pledge at whatever amount you'd like. There are some benefits, but most of all, I think it's just an expression of love and connection and saying, this is meaningful. And what's up here is meaningful to me. You can also buy Hawk Mountain, my first novel. You can give this show or that novel a warm review and a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and Goodreads and Amazon and all that kind of stuff. You can subscribe. You can just talk about the show and all that you can do in addition to patreon.com/ConnorHabib, or instead of, if you need to. If you already support in any of those ways, thank you so much. And I hope we continue to connect. All right, that's enough of that. Here's my episode with Sarah Maria Griffin. Hello, everybody. It's Against Everyone with Connor Habib. Hello again, Sarah Maria Griffin.
Hi, Connor. I'm very happy to be back.
My goodness. Like, you and I have interacted so many times since we did our first episode together, but that was years ago. It was right after I moved to Dublin.
Oh, my God. Was it that long ago?
Yeah. So it's been almost 5 years. Actually, it's been over, well, no, maybe not over 5 years, but it's been around 5 years since that first go. And anyway, I'm, you know, doing these episodes on work and, you know, the different kinds of jobs that I have and demystifying those, talking about those in ways that can be encouraging to other people to explore what's good and what's bad about work. So one of the things I was thinking to start with you, because we're going to talk about being writer, workers, whatever that is exactly, is how many questions about that work come out when you give a reading, there's the Q&A, and you get the same questions in one variation or another every single time. So like, so the questions I'm thinking of is like, where do you get your ideas?
Some variation of that. It's always the first one.
Do you have any advice for young writers? And like, what's your writing practice like? And then it comes along with like these observations, which I don't know why people do them. Like, do they not understand that they're, you know, like in some sense, I'd say that the setting is the character, an extra character, like those kinds of sort of canned things that people say. And that's fine. I mean, people all wake up to these sorts of things at in different times in their lives, and there's a first time I thought that about a story too.
Sex and the City.
Yeah. That was it. Yeah. No,
the city is truly at lunch with them every time.
Dogville. But I actually was thinking also that's part of the work is, you know, one, answering those questions. Maybe we should just answer those questions, but also mediating those questions being asked again and again, mediating the comments. But there's all sorts of things we can talk about. So let's just go where we want to go. But maybe I'll just pull that thread first.
Yeah, that's a really interesting one. I think when we're talking, I think something that I remember from college, and I did a master's in creative writing because I was full of optimism, and the world was different and no one could tell me any different. But something I was told again and again coming up as a young writer, a young person who wanted to be a professional writer, was that you can't. There's no money. You can't. And this, unfortunately, the more you tell me I can't, the more I will always say, oh, I can, including to my own detriment most of the time. But it made me more driven, and it sharpened me instead of blunting me. And I think that there is a fairly sizable myth about making a living and working as a writer and what a working writer looks like. And, you know, a working writer has to wear a lot of hats to get by, or they just have to wear a writing hat to get by. It really depends on where you are, what the season is. So much of it is weather. It changes all the time. And when it comes to talking about it as a job, something I'm trying to get past is being cowed by it. Because I do feel like I kind of committed this great heist. I stole a job, you know, in the thing I always wanted to do somehow against the odds. Lots of chips fell my way, some didn't. But I still somehow wake up every day with the work of writing being my thing I have to sit down to. And I think that feeling of having stolen something has to stop. That feeling of being cowed by, like, oh, I'm sorry that I'm a writer. I'm sorry that I've done this. Oh God, how could I have done this? You know, I think I've been full time since 2015 when I sold my 2-book deal, and I was working as a nanny in America, came home. I'd worked a million different jobs before then. Like, you name it, I've sold it. I've worked every shade of retail that you can imagine. And Urban Outfitters, Pets, GameStop, sold ice cream at Disney on Ice, worked in a pub for 5 years. Like, honest to God, I did all sorts of that, all sorts of mad jobs in service of getting to do this. And I think the real challenge I still have is not making it seem small or accidental.
Yeah, that's such a struggle in a lot of ways. Like, I talked about this, I had Caitlin Doty on, and we talked about, like, making content, you know?
Right.
Is that something she and I have both been doing for, you know, over a decade in both cases. But, like, something that's, like, frustrating about a lot of the jobs I've had or the work I do is people sort of casually saying, oh, I do that, or I've wanted to do that, right? And writing is definitely one of those. I mean, oh, yeah, I remember when I was getting my MFA and I talked to, you know, I was telling someone I want to be a writer. And I remember she said, it was just someone that I had just met, and she said, oh, I'm an unpublished poet. And I thought, okay, like, it's such a tangle for me when people say, oh, I'm writing, oh, I always want to write a book. Because on the one hand, you know, you want to not buy into some sort of gatekeeping role where you're like, yeah, but I'm actually doing this. Like, that's a different thing than what you saying that is a different thing than what I'm doing. And on the other hand, like, you don't want to diminish, like, so you don't want to be the gatekeeper, and you also don't want to diminish the fact that you are actually putting all this effort in. But you also then don't want to be like, I'm better because I put effort in. Because then again, there's, like, a problem there. So it's this, like, total tangle of even telling people what you do and hearing the initial response.
I don't often. I'll just say I'm a nanny. I still tell people I'm a nanny. I haven't looked after somebody else's child in, Jesus, nearly 10 years. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And I think something I have a real imperative around in terms of trying to karmically balance this theft feeling that I have is that I do a lot of mentorship work through the Arts Council and through Words Ireland, and I try to make sure that I'm aggressively supportive when people tell me that they're a writer, because I carry with me so many of those "but you can't" moments from my own past, while also having to balance a sense of non-apologetic, you know, like,
yeah.
For me, in order to not be apologizing for this, I have to make sure that I am aggressively holding the door open with my leg and making sure everybody else, I'm making sure that I'm, you know, being transparent, both by about how difficult it is and how rewarding it is, and all of the things that have had to happen in the right way at the right time, including my own labor and my own concentration and the things I've handed over for it. But lots of other things have to happen as well in order for it to pull off. But there's a certain point in time where considering yourself constantly lucky, is actually kind of harmful.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's like when we center that, when we center, oh, I've been so lucky, I've been so blessed, all that. Yeah, that is all true. But there's this other part that can get erased when you talk about or focus on that too much, which is that I've centered this act and this effort
at the cost of lots of other things in my
life. Exactly. And it doesn't, but see, I don't even want to mark it as sacrifice. I'm just like, I put this thing in the center. It's, you know, in the same way, there's that story about the guy who, it was in Oakland, I think, who there was like a median where traffic went on either side and people were, it, like, used that median. It was like there was tons of litter there. People were selling drugs. I mean, not that I necessarily have anything about drugs, and I definitely don't have anything about sex work, but they were selling drugs and there was like sex work and in this median in the neighborhood. But I mean, one of the main things about it was overgrown. There was just tons of like garbage there as well. A guy who lived in the neighborhood put a Buddha statue in the median, and like he just set this one thing there in the center, and suddenly people started littering less. Then they started picking it up. Then they started like gardening around it, planting flowers. Like everybody just started because this one thing was kind of at the center of it. And that's kind of how I view writing for me. It's like, if I put this thing in the center, like the rest of my aspects will cultivate my life around this, this presence. This
pursuit.
Yeah. And so I think it's really important to put that, you know, and not just center the luck and how it got here and the factors that came together. It's like, yeah, a lot of things probably did come together, but a lot of them came together because I've constantly put that image there, that presence there. And I've, you know, paid attention to that.
Actively manifested it, very deliberately made it happen. And again, it is, I believe it is the best job in the world still. I still think, like, because it's the job I always wanted to do, but it's also still a job. It's an unpredictable job. It's a job in which, unfortunately, you are taking the thing out of your body that makes that you know, your worldview, your experience, your insides, and you're putting them on the outside and selling them, and hopefully for enough money to pay for your life. And that's the point at which art meets capital is tricky and complicated. And I think that's something I didn't anticipate either. But my feeling is that if you do make it the very center of your life, other things have to fall away, and things I do think there is some sacrifice, but equally I have been making this I've been very myopic most of my life. If I start concentrating on something, unfortunately, everything else disappears. Fortunately, everything else disappears sometimes too. But I got this very singular idea of I want to be a writer into my head as a small child, and was very committed to it and very dedicated to it. So I didn't really try to be anything else. And that's an odd one, because I did briefly throw in the towel after burning out quite severely in 2019. I got very unwell and I needed to pull the plug. Also, I couldn't think, I couldn't do anything, I couldn't write. And I decided to retrain as a florist. And I found that incredible and challenging, and I was really bad at it, and then I got better at it, and I was getting finishing up my qualification as a commercial florist in March 2020, which I think we all remember as being a very important time in modern history. Not a lot of flower shops open at that time. But that was the first time that I said, okay.
A lot of arrangements being made, though.
On my life, Connor, my own father was in hospital with COVID. And we were, our last module that we did was in funeral arrangements. So I was building a crucifix out of pink roses. I can send you a picture. While texting my mom, she was like, is that okay? What's going on? And the radio was on and the nurses were chatting. Wow. There was a woman there who was a recently retired nurse who was going to go into floristry. Very strange vignette to be opening a pandemic on. So I had thought, you know, I'm going to go and do something else. I'm going to go do something with my hands. I'm going to go and do something that gets me up very early in the morning and both works with people and not with people and is engaged in every major event of people's lives, weddings, births, funerals, expressions of love, expressions of please forgive me, just because it's Wednesday, people buy flowers for one another all the time. And the mechanisms of floristry are fascinating to me. The world of it is something that I'm still obsessed with as a person who is not a florist, but I did decide to stop. And unfortunately, I couldn't. And when I couldn't get a job in a flower shop, I wrote a book about a flower shop. Mm-hmm. So I feel as though, yes, it is my job, but it is also a compulsion. It's also something that I would be doing anyway if it wasn't my job. Yeah. I would be doing it constantly. And I feel weird when I don't do it. Mm-hmm. It's something that I can't help. So when I'm in, say, to go back to your original question, in a Q&A, and people ask what my practice is, and I say something demented or deranged. Like, I really like these kind of pens and this kind of paper, and I write in the afternoon every single day. And I sound a bit like, I often find that maybe this is just, you know, I often feel like I sound like a teenager with a hobby, where I'm very excited about the shape, the fact that my day falls around these sort of episodes of writing that I can fit in and around the endless administration of being a freelancer. But I would be fitting those episodes of writing in no matter what I was doing. I would be standing in a freezing cold back room of a flower shop writing weird stuff into my phone in between putting things together. When I was a nanny, I waited till the kids went to bed and then would sit down at the giant kitchen island in the house in Noe Valley I worked in, and I would write. Like, I was fitting it in at every corner, and I don't know any other way to be.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, so first of all, a lot of writers wouldn't say that, right? I mean, I'm there with you, and I'm the same. But a lot of writers don't have that experience. And a lot of them say things that I can't understand, and in fact, sometimes get a little irritated by, like, oh, it's like the last thing I want to do.
Oh, is that Dorothy Parker? I love having written. Isn't that it?
Yeah, yeah. Or like, you know, yeah, anybody that's just like me, like starting my writing day and then it's like, you know, a video of them vacuuming and then cleaning and then, you know, doing anything they can to not write. I'm not like that. And in fact, like if I do that, like, yeah, writing will come to interrupt. Mm. That's really interesting, isn't it? It's very strange. And I think maybe, actually, like, there's a whole thing about it in The Seagull by Anton Chekhov, like, about being kind of tortured by having to continuously write notes down and stuff like that. But I think it is very strange to be someone for whom an image or a turn of phrase has to be expressed. When I say has to, yeah, you can ignore it, but it feels so bad and wrong to not take a note, to not write it down somewhere. It feels like you're letting go of something that could be really special or that, you know, wants to express and grow. That's so strange. Like, I know that musicians might have a very similar feeling, like a melody comes into their head and they just need to record some of it somehow. But this has been happening most of my life. Mm. And it even, I used to be really scared when I was a kid that there was a possession event happening sometimes. Like, I would start writing, and it was like automatic writing. And sometimes my pen would go through the page. I was writing so hard, and the stuff I was writing, sometimes it would be like across the page large.
Do you have consistent handwriting? No.
Do I have what?
Consistent handwriting.
I've deliberately changed my handwriting multiple times throughout my life. It's actually something that's really helpful when you have anxiety. Deliberately change your handwriting because it helps you.
Well, re-regulate. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, like reroute etheric body stuff. But anyway, so, but, you know, I would write these, and then, like, when they would condense a little bit, there would be these stories that just kind of didn't make sense. Like, one of the first stories I wrote was this guy who was, like, this woman fell in love with this guy that was made out of glass, and, like, he shattered, and then she just started setting, everything on fire. And, like, I was 16 or something. I had no idea, you know, where did that come from? And the same year I wrote a story about someone who had, like, crucified himself to the earth. Like, someone had pounded nails, but he was, like, on the earth. It's so interesting to me that these kind of transmissions come in.
Transmissions.
Whatever it is.
That's exactly what it is.
You know?
And, like, this is why I like talking to you so much, but also I'm often worried when I talk about writing to audiences that I sound nuts, because it is like that. It's like divination. And I have written myself countless times into corners because I am feeling something and I'm not guiding myself with my head. And I am trying very, very hard to permit myself structure and permit myself narrative beats and plot in order to save myself from realizing I've written 70,000 words of vibes, right, for the want of a better phrase, you know? Yeah. And I think that they do come out of nowhere. I mean, people respond in a kind of a surprised way when I tell them I'm a science fiction novelist. And because I don't really know any other way to describe what I write. And I think that it does just come out of somewhere that you don't know where it's from. And yeah, writing it down is an act of divination or an act of transmission. Like, it just comes from somewhere and it has to come out.
Yeah, it's like it's just deciding, you know, like people have lucid dreams or whatever where they can do what they want. I mean, sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. You do.
Uh-huh.
So people have like lucid dreams and they start like engaging with their dream. It's like writing is the act of like the lucid waking dream. Like, the thing comes to actually interact with you instead of letting you just pass through. There's this thing that Valentin Tomberg, who wrote Meditations on the Tarot, says somewhere in there. It's like, what is it? He's writing about making art. Like, we must not keep plunging into the darkness expecting the angels to rescue us. Meaning, you can't just work with the subconscious or the unconscious or the astral realm or the realm of dreams. That is how I did it when I was a kid, because it was just so overwhelming that I was like, it's just going to come out. But at a certain point, you can't wait to be you don't want to be rescued by the act of writing. You want to bring your waking self to it and bring those two worlds, that night world and that wake world, together.
High priestess. Sit in the middle.
yeah.
with my holy book under my arm. But you're right. I think that there's, on the craft level, I feel like every year I feel like I'm learning, and every year my taste gap widens. And I feel like for the last 2 years I've been working on a project that I am not good enough to write, and it is the cross on my back and the thorn in my side and the thing I need to write more than anything. So of course it's not the thing I'm currently writing. And it was something I'm taking out of my insides, and I'm maybe 40,000 words deep, and it was making me unhappy. Like, genuinely, I've spent, since the start of, is it 2 years on it? And I've been lucky enough to get grants to write it. And I'm very, cannot believe that the Arts Council gave me a grant to write a book about the end of the world and angels. And I think I've given myself this sort of 6-week break from it to write something else. and the speed at which I'm working on this new project has blown me away. And I think a bit of that speed is coming from that interception of, okay, let's actually not make a plan, but what if the feeling that I was trying to follow with this work was movement? Mm. I've been stuck. So what if I'm looking for movement? Mm. And that feeling of, or that process rather, of ensuring, sounds so silly to say, a story is moving along. Rather than I am taking something out of the fibers of my body that I need to expel or I will simply drown under it, is really curative. Mm. And my hope for this writing this spring was, or this kind of winter spring, was to remind myself that I could be a little builder as well as a divinator. That's not the right word, but you know, as well as
a diviner.
Yeah.
I mean, I love that you said little builder, because the thing I kept thinking was, you know, sometimes you have to write a book to write another book. Mm. And I don't think that people really generally know that. They think like, oh, this is the book I'm going to write. But other books have to come first. Mm. And the same thing happened with me. I was writing my second novel and I was just not up to it. I know the structure of it. I have the whole thing broken down, start to finish. And I kind of know the tone, but I wrote, I don't know, like, you know, maybe 100 pages or something. And I was like, it's just not good enough. And it's not that I feel like bad about myself or something. It's still pretty good, but it's not good enough for what it needs to be. I'm not honoring the thing. So I started writing this other book and now I'm almost done with it. And it just like came out.
It's long, yeah.
And I think a lot of what I'm seeing is a lot of what I want to put into that other novel is coming out in this book that I'm almost finished with now. So some of it's like, oh, that stuff wasn't supposed to go in there. That was supposed to be in this.
It was meant to go somewhere else.
You need to really build your way to each book. And from book to book, you're building. And I have one other thing I want to say, and you can pick up whatever point you want here. But when you're talking about, you know, giving yourself plot or whatever, I've always viewed plot as like, I mean, as you know, Hawk Mountain's really plot heavy, and I love plot. I fucking love it. But the reason why I love it is because plot is stakes that you put in the ground so you can, you've given yourself the permission to fully engage in style. So it's like, I move from point stake A to point stake B. I've set those up not because I'm trying to write a plot-based book, but because now I can exercise and express and evince and allow the freedom of my style. So it's like yarn wrapping around those stakes until I get to the end. But the style is really where it's at. But the plot is the only thing that allows me to do it.
Yeah.
And I think that that's why, like, if you read a hyper-experimental novel, there are some that I like and some that I don't like. But when it doesn't have plot, there are good ones where you think, okay, this person has deliberately like removed the stakes of plot. And then there are some where I think that the person just couldn't do plot and therefore their style is suffering. Mm. So it's just the difference between like, if you imagine weaving the whole thing and then pulling the stakes out and then like, you know, versus what do I do with all this yarn, you know?
What do I do with all this
what
yarn?
What do I do with
that
the yarn?
So yeah. Real. I would actually say of Hawk Mountain, I think part of its power is that it's really accelerated, but you can't see the machine. You can just feel the propulsion, which is why something I loved about it.
That's
was that
nice,
it's,
yeah.
Like it is, the plot is excellent, but you don't feel, you can't see the stakes for all the yarn. Do you know what I mean? But you can see the integrity of it working there. And I think I think I'm trying to learn at my big age, like 4 books in the can, I'm learning about plot at last. But But I think because... I mean,
there's plot. There's a lot, plenty of plot in your last two novels. It's just weird plot.
Yeah, that's true. And the next two are much better on the plot. We're learning and growing every day. My editor was very kind to me. And she said to me recently, she's like, you just didn't do an ending in this one recently. I was like, that is the third time that I have done this, or I have finished a novel, handed it in and gone, oh, it's just missing 20,000 words at the end. Like, it just stops. And for some reason, while I'm in it, I can't see that. But what I'm trying to give myself at this juncture is the stakes and the waypoints, because that serves the reader, you know, and as well as me. It serves everybody. It exists for a reason. And I think what surprised me with this kind of work that I'm doing so I can do the other work is I've been having a really joyous experience with it. I've been excited to keep going, and in the evening at around 9 o'clock, when we've all settled in for the night, TV's on, I'm still writing it. And I might look down and have a 3,000 word day, which is not something I don't think I've had ever, maybe.
Okay, let me just actually, I want to break down some of the actual stuff that you just said for people listening, because it's so weird how mystified the mystification of writing is for people, including a lot of writers. But let's just I just want to break down some of the actual mechanics, right?
Yeah.
First of all, I never write to a word count ever.
Oh, don't you? I love them.
Pages sometimes, but really I write a certain time, length of time. And also, I write really fast. And so when I hear about people that are agonizing over something for the longest time, I'm like Hawk Mountain was 7 months, something like that. Now, in fairness, I'd written it in other forms before, but pretty much everything I write, it's pretty quick. And so that's not saying it's better or worse than anybody. I'm not, or the word count thing, I'm not saying to people that are listening, oh, do it this way, not that way. But for me, I write fast and I don't edit. There's almost no edits really in Hawk Mountain either. There are things I added, some scenes I added. And there were a few things that were confusing that had to be cut out or messed with after I gave it to the editor. When I had conversations with the publisher, but mostly it's not really edited, and that's because I do it along the way. So I'm first of all just fascinated by this, the length that it takes some people to write things. I'm I don't know how you do that. 4 hours at Hawk Mountain was 4 hours a day, for a good long period of time. And that's the most I would ever do. Now with this book, it's 1 or 2 hours a day. So also I want to talk about the, I've pulled off a crime. Oh, I'm only working 2 hours a day. But also, friends, I have the podcast and the events and the, all the other things I do. So it's a lot of work. Not that I have to, excuse myself by saying I work so hard every day, but I do. But just to say, I'm fascinated by the duration differences between you and I, and also, just the way that people pick different mechanics and why these ideas and these practices come to us differently. Where do we learn them from? Who set them in stone for us? And also, is there a good version and a bad version? I don't know.
Metrics are tricky, and I use the word count as a means of feeling as though I have done something, because so much of it is on one hand, I want to be the kind of person who's writing isn't hard. You can do it and I feel there are times of which for me it is not. And there's a lot of time in my life in which concentration is hard. Life in general is hard, and I'm alone with a Word document. And you got to keep in mind as well, I just come off the end of 3 years living in a pretty isolated place. And the work was kind of all I had, and it kind of started biting back a bit. It's a very solitary craft is the thing. And I think that the counting of the movement forward helps me feel a bit less. I'm actually just noticing I, You, We, Them on your bookshelf, which by Dan Gretton. And on the cover of that, there's these the strokes that people make on the inside of a jail cell. You know, the four the strokes and the one line. Yeah. That's what the word count is for me. And because forcing the times at which writing feels like pulling teeth, if I can make it to the thousand, I at least feel like I've made a dent in the hill today, you know. And then when it feels like pleasure, which it does at the moment, it's look what I am capable of doing when I can think clearly and when I feel good, you know.
Do you get agitated? So when I'm writing something, I, a lot of times, especially if it's a short story, I want to get to the end very quickly because I want to read it to my boyfriend.
Oh, I read Carrie. Yeah.
You do?
Yeah, every day.
So I get your husband, just so people
know. That's my husband, yeah.
So when I get very, like, I'm bringing that up to say that you can feel alone in the pleasure too. It's like, it's so confined because you're feeling this agitation and excitement about something that's appearing through and with you, and you can't show it to anybody really until it finds some resting point that you can show it, you know. And so I'm just very like, I feel excited when I'm writing, and then also I feel this, yeah, again, this agitation. And that brings its own sense of aloneness too. So even when I'm feeling good about it, I'm
you're like, talking to the CEO of Alone in the Work.
Yeah.
Like, for real. I mean, I have two projects, shall we say, on the way.
Say it in the way that doesn't actually give it.
Let's do a big talking around things. I wrote two novels in the last bunch of time that people will be able to read. at some point, which I cannot currently discuss.
Not too long from now, we'll say that. Yeah, not in a galaxy far, far away.
I started writing one of those novels in the year of our Lord, 2018. And it is now 2024.
Yeah.
And no one will be able to read it until 2000XX. You know, I'm very vulnerable in this work. I mean, my agent is tremendous and gives incredible notes, and I feel that they've witnessed it. So I feel like, okay, well, you know, it's, I know it's not terrible, but also it's, and obviously it's, you know, it exists in the world. It's, I'm not going to talk it down. I know it's, I worked very hard on it. It's also my longest work. It's 120,000 words. But but
chill out, Norman.
Yeah, no, relax, dial it back. It could be 80. No, it couldn't be 80, unfortunately, this time. But so I wrote that over the course of a bunch of years, and then I wrote the floristry book over a course of years. I don't show people my work socially. It's just me and Microsoft Word. It's just us, just me in that blank space. And it feels a little bit like that old thing of, oh, I have a boyfriend, but I met him in the Gaeltacht.
He's from
Limerick.
That's the Irish equivalent of saying you have a girlfriend who lives in Niagara Falls.
Yeah, she's real, you know. So I feel like a great deal of my writing is like talking about something that doesn't exist. And it's, I kind of have had to make bedmates with that. I've had to be like, okay, this is just my girlfriend from Limerick. That's what we're talking about, you know, who I met in Inishmore, and that's real and a real thing that happened. And the time will come where that ebbs off me, I know. But the loneliness in it is something I've had to make peace with, because if it's not, the thing about writing is that it's very different from publishing. Writing and publishing are two different things. And two different worlds which intersect very, very tightly, and are not, publishing is dependent on writing, but writing isn't always dependent on publishing, if you know what I mean. Capital W, capital P, you know. And I have had to very firmly disassociate my daily practice from capital P publishing, although it directly affects me, because of the silence and because of the road in. And that has been really tough, but I think I have become, I think it's made me like it more, you know.
Yeah, I have an episode coming out about the publishing industry, but I do want to talk about this aspect of things with you. I mean, it is such a weird relationship. Now, I've been blessed, but anyway, Norton, who put out Hawk Mountain, is just like the primary publisher who put out Hawk Mountain has just been like amazing. Everything about it has been great. And like, it is just a completely different thing than writing. And I don't think people understand how stressful the making sure your artwork goes through these channels, including an agent and a publisher. Like, so just to like give a very quick rundown. So, okay. So I wrote this, I was writing this novel when I lived in San Francisco years and years ago.
An important detail is that Connor and I lived in San Francisco at the same time.
We did, yeah.
Like, our paths never crossed.
In like a never when time. So, and I wrote like 200 pages of a novel, never did anything with it. Yeah. Okay. Then I got an advance to write a book about sex, a nonfiction book. I wrote the whole thing and had all these clashes with the publisher. The person, I just thought she was an absolute maniac. She was like anti-sex work. Why did she even ask me to like, you know, pay for the book? Wrote that whole book and never came out. You can still, I think, find the horrible cover that and title that they picked for it online somewhere. So that never came out. Then got an agent. So I did all that without an agent. Then got an agent. She was super cool, was working on a nonfiction proposal. And then there was a major, without kind of the big reveal about it, like major life-shattering event for this agent. So had to leave her, find another agent. It's like, these are the things that people don't see as part of the trajectory of becoming a writer worker, is that there are all these relationships that need to actually work, and they need to work. It's not just the relationship that needs to work. Both people's lives need to be working. And then there needs to be like successes through those relationships. And then the relationship with the publisher has to be great. It's like you're mediating so much. And for writers, you know, luckily you're Irish and I'm just a social enough person if I need to be. So like, but I do think about it as people who just, you know, those kinds of writers that just all they can really do is write, and they can't really manage those kinds of relationships. And that's actually a demand of being a writer worker. And that's pretty crazy.
Because it's so different from the bit where you sit on your own with Microsoft Word forever.
Yes. And
if you sit on your own with Microsoft Word for too long, it makes you weird, which is my experience. Didn't need to be made any weirder. But I definitely think that there is such a human side of it. Publishing is made of people, and it's made, like, it's only ever a matter of time before I start talking about Jim Henson at any point. But there's this whole, my favorite song from The Muppet Show.
Time to light the lights.
Genuinely, my favorite song from The Muppet Show is If Just One Person Believes in You, which I think it was Bernadette Peters sang with Kermit the Frog. Incredible scenes, devastating. But the whole premise of that is that it's, you know, if just one person believes in you, deep enough and strong enough believes in you, right? That it's the vouching of one person will then go, oh, well, then if two more people believe in you, and then if three more people. Publishing is made of people who believe in your ability, your work, who will take a chance on you, who will take financial risk on you, who will go into business partnership with you as your agent does, both on the strength of their faith in your ability, and not only their faith in your ability, but their faith in your ability to make money. So obviously there is it's business, it's industry. So it's the point at which you and Microsoft Word, or you and your notebooks, or whatever your process is, meet industry. And I have had a mad road in. I have not had a road in that I would point anyone to. Very not straightforward, very climbing in windows, doing wild things. And I think at the moment I've hit a lovely, oh my God, actually, I'm even afraid to say I've hit a lovely patch. But I know some people for whom it has been extremely straightforward. I know some people for whom it has been very chaotic, and nobody really has, there's not real one size fits all experience for writers. But at the same time, I was speaking to a friend of mine who works in a completely different industry, and explaining to her how highly tied up your sense of self ends up being in your relationship with publishing as a writer, because you want, obviously there's a self-centered thing where you're like, I want people to read my work, I want to be witnessed in my art, da da da, you know, all this sort of stuff. But she, I was like, you know, I was explaining to her something that had kicked my ass, you know, and she, like, really it had wrung me out, and I was like, I just wish it didn't hurt. And she kind of looked at me and she said, industry is supposed to hurt.
Yeah.
All industry hurts because you're a worker. Industry doesn't, you know what I mean?
It's Charlie Chaplin on the gears in Hard Times, like literally like on the gears, you know, being sucked in to the factory. Yeah.
And like, so you have these incredible, like it's, you have, ultimately it's work. And then your work becomes other people's work, which I think is like, I have had an incredible experience recently with a cover, and I felt like this huge echo of this, oh my God, the time at which this book arrived in me, and the how many people had to read that book and understand it to come back with this image, right? Yeah. I'm getting like emotionally thinking about it because I was alone with it for so long, to be faced with this image where it was very apparent that several people completely understood what I was trying to say. And that special. that there was like, oh God, this is it. This is the feeling of people believing in you.
Yeah, that's really, I love that you chose that, because that's how I feel about the American cover of Hawk Mountain, especially. I'm just like,
it's beautiful. Yeah. Like with the orange and the yellow, like it's so beautiful.
And it's like a knockoff of Catcher in the Rye, but it's like,
that's, it's in conversation with Catcher.
Exactly. It's so, it's so funny. Someone, this is part of writer work too. Like someone, some like doof, like on Goodreads was like, I can't believe that they actually let this pass. Like, what if people think it's a sequel to Catcher in the Rye? And I was like, are you kidding? What? First of all, who cares? No. But I wish they would, because then I could sell. Yeah. But anyway, so yeah, I mean, I think it's like, it's kind of like, you know, when you experience a traumatic event and you're the only one there with maybe the one abusive person that like treated you horribly, and then you feel like you have to tell everybody. This is kind of like when you see something that's beautiful or that's exciting, mm-hmm. and you're the only one there, and you're like,
you're alone,
if nobody else sees this, like, what's going to happen? If like, someone's going
to
see it.
If a book cover is designed in a wood and there's no one around to see it. Yeah,
it's, totally.
It's funny. So there's this real duality to it as a job where you're by yourself professionally.
Yeah.
But then you also have to go and be among people in a way where you are selling them part of yourself.
Yeah. You know? I mean, that is really like a big, I mean, I know there are other arts that are like this as well, but just to say, I'm not painting anything. I can't show an image. What I'm doing is putting down symbols that, you know, these letters, these like strings of symbols that are translating moods, pictures, tones, feelings that are occurring with me as I kind of think through my hands. And then after that, you know, it goes out into the world and someone has to recreate what I experienced through these symbols that I've put down on the page. That's so weird. It's so weird.
Oh, yeah.
Like, because it's not an act of a direct showing, like a painting or a film or even a song in a way, although maybe music is a little closer. It's actually like the reader has to rebuild from what you've given, what you imagine from what you've given in words and symbols. And
they
letters.
Have to want to do it for long enough to get through 380 pages.
And there has to be enough there for them to be able to do it in their way. Mm-hmm. So it's individual, but that doesn't lose
your voice.
some, yeah, the essence or whatever it is that was trying to come through. And so you are so alone in that. You're alone as you do it. You're mediating the forces and the images and the things that come through, usually from some sort of astral plane. And then it's gone, and you're like, okay, here's the thing for you to decode or to rebuild or to build with and to work with, and then have that connection to the portal that I saw into. That's really weird.
It's wild.
And you also can't, like, you could sit down, if you made a movie, you could sit down and watch the movie you made with someone, yeah, you know, next to you. You can't really sit next to someone while they're reading your book. I mean, I guess you could, but it would be absolutely insane. So there's such a solitude. And then, you know, when you enter into the economic realm, you know, and the political realm of, like, negotiating with publishers and agents and stuff like that, it's just completely different work. It's just completely different. It's very difficult.
It's, and there's other, and there's obviously a dozen other jobs writers have to be able to do as well. Like, I often kind of point to how much of my day I lose to capital A admin, and the means of sustaining yourself, and the other bits and pieces we find ourselves doing in order to move forward. Like, I'm not really a teacher, you know, but I do a bit of teaching.
Would you give that up? I'm sorry. Like, I've been wanting to ask you this whole interview, and now you're bringing a conversation and you're bringing it up. Would you give all that stuff up if you could just write? And I know it's a hard, no one's going to judge you or hire you to base it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
One in a heartbeat. I really, really would, because I'm really selfish and it makes me really happy. And I think I'm better at it than I am at teaching. I'm more comfortable. I'm like more, my dream job is actually to be a late night radio presenter. That was what I really wanted to do, you know, and podcasts are pretty close because you're in someone's ears somewhere. And that means a lot to me. I would give it all up if I was able to sing really well. Mm. I would give it all up if I was able to draw really well. It always comes down to if I could be totally total at something, I would give up all the other little bits. I think spinning too many plates made me very unwell. And I learned a very hard lesson in 2019 about what happens to you when you spread yourself too thin. I got a very bad fright. And I made a really serious commitment after that to myself that I was going to kind of put my health first and move away from doing everything all of the time. And I have taken some small forays back into teaching and hosting since, but it's been very different. And because I know in my heart of hearts, especially after the pandemic, when a lot of that work fell away organically because of the way the world was, that I am most peaceful when I'm just writing.
Isn't it so strange? So it's like, I want that too. I mean, that's not a comment on all you listening, or the other things that I've done in my life that I love. There are plenty of things that I love. I love doing this. I love teaching. I love plenty of things. But really, when I think about what I'm meant to be doing,
it's that, yeah.
And I think about someone like Jam Katsia, who almost never does interviews, has never had social media, of course, won the Nobel Prize, like, is basically just writes his books and turns them in. And the peace of that is, I mean, can you just imagine? Like, and that kind of position for a writer seems unavailable now, but I actually think it's going to become much more and more available as time goes on. And I think people actually seek writers more and more that are that have somehow removed themselves from these other frames. And that is my longing. I used to say a writer's prayer was like, Lord, make me successful enough to leave Twitter. You know, like, that's a writer's prayer.
You know, it's like, I felt when I left Twitter in September after 14 years. And I left because something bad happened to my friend, and I was like, well, this is the moment, you know, you've seen too much.
Yeah,
we're not going back. And I miss it because for a long time it was my water cooler. Do you know? I was kind of like, this is where I stand and I talk to other writers. Got me a lot of work over the years. Unfortunately, the best thing that can happen when you make a good tweet is that you are followed around by it like a specter for the rest of your life. Currently being pursued hotly by a tweet I made a couple of years ago. And I'm aware that that is the most read piece of work.
Yeah, I saw that.
The most read piece of work I will ever produce is a tweet about why burgers shouldn't be tall. They should be wide instead. Somebody texted me to tell me that their waiter quoted it to them. Did you see that tweet about the burgers? And I was like, oh my God, that's it. That's my contribution.
Do you know that I had this to tweet like a few months ago that it was about Israel and Palestine, and that so first of all, Bella Hadid retweeted it, and then some guy from Grey's Anatomy, I forget the like really hot one, but then the Palestinian representative to United Nations incorporated it into their speech.
Oh my God.
And it was not.
I did see that.
Yeah, it was not like. And I mean, it was so wild. I mean, they had changed it slightly, but it was obvious that it was based on the thing that I had written. And, but anyway.
At least yours was for good, Connor.
Yeah. Well, so was yours.
At least yours
was good. So he's changing burgers everywhere.
I'm yet to see a frisbee sized one. Yeah. I'm waiting.
But I mean, I think that's like.
It was the power of Twitter, you know. It was a writer's place.
But I still don't. I mean, I'm glad that there's like some contribution there. But like, I find I just want out of the whole realm of that kind of public expression more and more the idea of people who aren't entangled in the world that way offering the contribution of writing fiction it's just going to be strengthened. I wish I could tell you exactly why, but it was something Caitlin and I really noticed about content creation that after doing this for years, she and I come to the same conclusion, which is like, this is kind of going away. Now, what do we do about it? And we couldn't articulate all the reasons why, but as two people, and then I asked a lot of other people who like make content, and they all kind of said the same thing. They're like, yeah, this is going away. It's like stopping. It's hard to articulate why or how, but it's just kind of like trying to get ahead of that and figure out what to do. And rather than trying to reproduce it somehow, just actually, how do I live without it, but in a way that acknowledges that it exists as well. So you don't
with
just
content
pretend
creation
it's not there.
And making content, as somebody who makes a lot of sort of accidental content or like, makes posts about my animals and things like that in a very particular way that's designed to be read. But I have, you know, I'm a poster at heart. I love to make posts.
You do.
I do. I love posting. I love the internet. I
love posting.
I do. I'll never log off.
Post-it notes.
I will simply never log off as long as I live. I think that there is a feeling that you're always, for me anyway, probably better say something demented, but posting with a capital P, content creation, whatever. I'm not a content creator, I'm a poster. But I don't know. I count podcasts as another thing. I feel very strongly about podcasts in general. I'm actually writing something about them at the moment. I have a lot of very good feelings about them. But I think in terms of posts and making posts and generating content for the internet with a capital C, like there's a sense of being in service to this, to the algorithm. And what is the algorithm but a kind of a man-made god which decides who thrives and who fails? So I feel very complicated about making posts, capital P, and throwing them into the wind in hope that this artificial god will select them to show them to people. Like there's sort of a bit of engaging with engaging with something that I feel is kind of dark there, you know? And a part of me feels like it's necessary evil because I wonder sometimes, is the path to freedom in your work having enough good posts? Dude, that's actually so stupid when I say it out loud. I'm like, what if I just made enough good posts?
Well,
then I'd never have to post again. That's the trap.
That's it, exactly.
Like, oh my God. But also, I love the internet, so I will never log off. I'm interested in it. I feel like a citizen of a place that doesn't exist. And I will never find all the answers to the internet, you know, but I do think that there is something in freeing yourself. I miss Twitter. I feel weird about not having a place to make my stupid jokes anymore. And I write them in my notes app and I'm sure they'll find themselves elsewhere. But I do feel better about my fiction.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, it, of course, the correlation's like pretty obvious.
Siphoning off your creativity into the right place, you know?
And I mean, yeah, and I mean, talking about like writing and publishing, it was so obvious when I moved to Ireland. It's not quite as obvious in the US, but it was so obvious when I moved to Ireland that like the kind of low stakes memoir and book creation that revolved around people having some kind of presence on Twitter, especially, and to a lesser extent, Instagram, although now it's probably switched. Like, there were just tons of people that had books coming out. And in Ireland, from Irish publishers, because they had that presence online. Now, maybe that sounds so obvious to people, because in the US, it's like, oh, well, so-and-so has, like, you know, 700,000 followers. They got a book deal for a lot of money. But in Ireland, it was like, oh, they have 7,000 followers, and somehow that looks big on this, like, small island. So we'll give them a memoir deal. And they have some sort of notoriety somewhere else. Maybe they write, for a newspaper occasionally or something like that. And we'll just put out their book. And that curation process is so poisonous. And so when Twitter was like really starting to fall apart and people were like, oh, well, what's going to happen to all, you know, writers and what? And I just thought, well, the way that this is actually truly poisoned publishing is so awful. Maybe there's a way in which it's good for writers, but the way in which this has actually completely polluted the curation well for publishers has been awful. And it's happening everywhere, like in, you know, smaller or larger scale. And I'm also thinking about that move to being someone who's not selected that way. You know, I have to admit that in some ways I was selected to be able to publish a book because of the platform that I built, which Twitter definitely played a huge part in early on. Mm. I don't think they looked at my Twitter followers and were like, oh, you have whatever it was at the time, 60,000 or something, so let's give you a deal for a novel. It was like, but that played a part in being able to have a podcast. It platform. Played a part in having, yeah, like a voice when I was making movies, all that kind of stuff. And so it just got me to know a lot of people in the same way that you're saying it got you a lot of work. But imagine now the people that can be and will be selected without that process the kind of standard and I don't like the word purity, but the kind of standard and strength that
I don't think you should have to be. I don't think you should have to be good at posting. Do you know?
Or platform building, basically.
At all. Yeah. I don't think so. And I think I really love the internet. And I think that's, and I'm not going to pretend I don't. I'm not going to say.
You should see the face she's making. It's like she's drinking a cup of hot cocoa.
I think the finest pro stylist it's of like our this, time is Drill, Connor. Yeah. Like, I really do. Like, I truly.
Yeah, he's pretty great.
Unbelievable. Like, yeah. I think that there's. If I could pretend that I was above it, I would. But I'm not. And I completely also agree with you. I think that. I think Twitter for me acted for many years as a showcase of my ability. And then when I stopped having to do the pageantry of it, the way I think about things changed, you know. And I know lots of writers who've left Twitter for loads of different reasons. I have one friend in particular who was like, hit 30,000 followers and was like, cool, I've beaten the game, I'm done.
Yeah.
That was genuinely enough for her. And I think it's an environment, it's a place, there's a lot of things about it that are, and it also, you choose every follow yourself, you know, you build your own landscape. And I think that there is, I'm so obsessed with it still, and even though I'm gone, but I do think you're right that there's, what if we just went back to the slush pile, you know, like, I don't know. But then I say that as a person who's never had to read a slush pile in her life.
I had to. I used to work for Kelly Link's literary journal. Just a very brief time. Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet. Yes. Yeah. For a very short time, I was an intern for them. And like reading that slush, that was crazy. I mean, that's something else about, you know, the idea was to build a literary career, you would publish a few stories and then those would somehow get noticed and then you could get an agent and then you could publish a novel. That was like the path, and it was a path of torment. I mean, it's an excruciating path for people. And like, you know, then you just, instead of having Twitter, you had the sort of in club of MFA programs, which are just a total shit show. And for most part, like, can be a tremendous waste of fucking time and money and effort. It's just awful. And really, like, scrape people's nervous systems out. But, like, when I was reading, it was like, am I in a bad mood today? Well, I'll really only give this story 4 sentences. Like, you really just got this idea of how it worked. It was completely fucking random. Whereas if I'd been, like, in a completely great mood, I would, like, really read the whole thing with the same level of enthusiasm the whole way through. And it's totally unfair. And when I saw that working, I was like, you know, I'm sure anybody who's tried to publish something, send something out to a journal, you get rejected, as I've been rejected many, many times.
The unifier.
And then you read the journal and you're like, these stories are shit. Why did they pick these and not mine? You know? And you're like, what the fuck was wrong? And it's like, bad mood day when they read yours. Maybe there was 2 stories that were about the same thing and yours was one of them that day.
It's whatever. It's wild. It's zeitgeist, subjectivity. It's actually incredible that anything ever gets published at all. Do you know, when you start looking at it, you're like, yeah, wow. But I think that, to go back to what you said about Twitter, it, like, I definitely was a person who made enough good posts to get a lot of things to get published when I was in the first place. I know that, especially in Ireland,
from
that
good post to on post.
Good post to on post. Oh my God, from good post to on post. You just can have that one. That's pretty good. But I think that was, like, that was, you know, that was a big part of my life. And I definitely know that there's plenty of such paths I didn't make it through. Some I did. You only ever have to make it through some. But I think that's the unifier. Like, that is what anybody who goes into the industry and goes into the work, capital W work, and it's something that you hear said again and again. What advice do you have to give people? Like, going back to your first question, what advice do you have to give? Like, what is it like being a writer? There's a lot of rejection, a lot of people saying no, but only one person has to say yes and convince some more people to say yes, you know? So I think that that's the real unifying thing that everybody in the job goes through, is that it's a world and an industry built of no until it's a world of yes, you know?
Yeah, it's so hard because, like, one of the things that so many writers ask me if they're starting, like, you know, I do writing coaching and people hire me for that. And so a lot of times I'll just be like, can you just tell me if it's bad? Does it suck? And I'm like, I cannot tell you that. Like, it's not because I don't have an opinion as to whether or not it sucks. It's, you have to be able to develop that sense on your own. And so that continues throughout your entire career until you get to the point where someone puts a book out and it actually really does change things internally for you. And I wish that it weren't so. Mm-hmm. But when that first book comes out, you told me this when Hawk Mountain came out, you're like, people are going to start talking to you differently. You're going to say different things. People are going to hear what you say differently. And it was very true. And I mean, in some ways, it's completely unfair. Like, I think about James Joyce, you know, like, getting his, like, was it Ezra Pound's, you know, poems? And he's like, well, I will read your poems, but I'll give them no more regard than any other person's poems off the street. You know, like, having the strength to be someone that actually just reads a book and doesn't take it, you know, more seriously just because it's published. But it is true.
I think, you know what keeps me good with that, actually, is zines. I think reading a lot of zines and picking up as many zines as I can keeps me in that space where I can pick up things and read them as they are and get reading pleasure out of things. I also read a lot of fan fiction.
Yeah.
So I think in terms of workers, you want to talk about workers? It's the girls in the fan fiction minds who are writing 250,000 words of Succession fan fiction without putting their name on it, purely for the joy alone. Yeah. You know, they're working out there for nothing but pleasure, you know? And I think that reading outside of publishing helps me, because I don't know if it's forever, you know?
Yeah.
It's for now. It's for 2024 and 2025. But it's, you know, I don't know if it's forever. I know I'll always write. Mm. But I've just come out of I won't say a fallow season, because that's not fair on the work that I've been doing. But it will be 5 years between Other Words for Smoke and my next book. And I've been working my absolute arse off. I've been working really hard in a way that nobody can see. And I've had to hold that and let that keep me warm. And I think the reading that I dig out and the zines I pick up and the zines I order and the fan fiction and the posts, you know, the things that I read that don't have a spine reminds me that even if it's not forever, I'll still find a way to transmit.
Yeah, and receive the transmission. Let's take it back a little bit to those initial questions. The where do you get your ideas from question, you know, Harlan Ellison used to joke, he'd be like, I fucking think them, you know, like that was I always thought that was funny. I mean, he just had no patience for anybody, but
I think it's a really vulnerable question because I think whenever I start answering that, I sound demented.
Well, yes, because you're trying to answer honestly. I think people ask out of some sort of, one, it's either mystified or they think that there's a demystified answer, which is, okay, there can be no possible answer. This is crazy. How do people think these things up? Or there must be some sort of material way in which these ideas come into people's head. Maybe they see something that they think is interesting and they select it for this reason or that reason. But like actually, you know, the where is such a weird way to phrase it. So is it, it's like this imaginal dimension, you know, that has its own power and potency that can be really fucking crushing sometimes. And I really loathe writers that like puff themselves up about how hard it is all the time to work with like the, you know, emotional judo that it takes to write. However, sometimes that is true. And I have to acknowledge that when I, you know, when I read the audiobook, for instance, of Hawk Mountain, that was condensed. I think I've told you this story before, but that was like, I had to read that whole book, which was extremely like close emotionally for me, in the span of 3 days out loud. I was sick. My voice was like completely hoarse. And I was going through the book itself, which is very difficult and tense and like, well, it's an easy read, but it's like difficult, you know, stuff happens in it, challenging stuff and painful stuff. And so I'm like reading it. And then my boyfriend took me out to dinner the night I finished, because I'd always wanted to record my own audiobook. And I was like, all I could talk about was trauma that had happened in my life. And then I got up to go to the bathroom and I didn't even know. I like knocked my napkin into the candle and it like almost consumed the table. Oh, he had to like put it out. So like I literally was like traumatized and trying to burn the place down, you know, through my unconscious. And he was just like, I just wanted to take you out to dinner. You know? So, but that indicates to me how hard that journey must have been all the way through, and what you are mediating and tamping down and letting flow in.
And you pulled back and you looked at the mountain.
Totally.
You were walking up it and then you suddenly saw what you had built.
Yeah, totally. And I don't want to maybe go too much into this, but writing the book that I had to put on hold for a little bit, I was trying to describe a really violent thing and I didn't know what it looked like. So I looked it up. I watched a video of it and I had to like just sit with that image for a really long time. I was like, how am I going to let this in to like make sure I get it right? But not, I mean, I don't do a lot of research, but this was just a particularly important thing for the book. And I was like, I need to know what that actually looks like. So I watched something really horrific and violent online. Now, usually I wouldn't watch something like that happening. I didn't watch anything for Hawk Mountain, even though there's gruesome shit in there. But even just imagining it and sitting with that violent imagination for a long time, you have scary characters in your books. It's like letting them live in you, you know, being in constant contact with them. It is actually threatening sometimes. And I don't want to overdo it, but it is true.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The book that I am currently also have on pause, and it's really thick in. It's really thick in, and I'm going to finish it. And it's about, do you know, again, whenever I start describing it, it's just catch myself talking and it doesn't make any sense, but it's about the end of the world is the easiest way to put it. But it's also about incarceration and sisterhood and family, and it's also about sex. And as I was building it out, and there's also a whole bunch in it about being a nanny. I've finally done it. A whole bunch of it. The navigation system that I'm doing emotionally with the character that I'm walking through the bigger backdrop, she does some pretty unfair things, and to her own end. I was like, it's so possible to bum yourself out, to be light about it. Like, it's so possible to get too close that you cannot see the wood for the trees. You cannot see the work. You have just bummed yourself out. The project is a bummer. You can't, the pleasure is gone, and you've put yourself so far into it that you can't write it. You're just in it.
Yeah.
And that is where time gets wasted. It's where you can't work. On one hand, like, something my dad says to me often is just like, you're not a fucking coal miner, Sarah. And he's right. Do you know what I mean? Best job in the world. Writing isn't hard, right? But at the same time, you can really fuck with your own head if you want to.
Totally.
And sometimes you need to. But I think, like we said earlier, going down the path of not quite cheering ourselves up, but writing an antidotal work to restore the ability that you have to actually do the heavy work is a good idea too. You know, like, it's writing both isn't hard, but it also, we can make it hard for ourselves if we're let. And part of the trickiness of writing being a very isolated job is that no one's around to catch you. Mm-hmm. You're responsible for your own sanity, ultimately, you know, and it's very, very hard to balance that line. But I think it's also doable, you know.
And there are things that make you, I mean, I read you a story a while ago.
Thought about it almost every day since.
I mean, that was a few years ago.
And, yeah, for real.
There's a part of that story that I was so, messed up by having written it. So, like, I wrote it and I kind of didn't think twice about it. But there was part of it that when I looked back on it, I was like, oh, fuck. Like, that's really, really brutal.
I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And yeah. I, and the only reason why I'm like not saying what the story is I don't know if it's ever going to come out. It's, but if it does, you know, I don't want to give it away. But I was just thinking, like, what am I that I wrote that?
That's the same feeling you were talking about earlier when you're 16, writing the Man Made of Glass. Same feeling.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. But this time it's like real guilt, you know. I think it's like, it's kind of like wonder when it was coming out at a certain point. But, you know, like, I was thinking about, again, Harlan Ellison. He was like, I want to, like, people want me to be like a friend to the audience. He's like, I want to savage my readers. I want them to feel threatened, you know? And I find that very alluring. Like, I don't know what that's about. And I don't know where the line is. Actually, I think I might kind of know where the line is for me, but I don't know exactly. But when I watch movies like that or read a book like that, if it's well done, I'm always so affected by it. In such a profound and moving way.
That's horror, though, isn't it? Horror is such a fine line to walk.
Yeah.
It's such a difficult conjuring act. You know, how to generate an atmosphere of menace and fear while also making sure the reader feels exactly the right amount of safe and wrong amount of safe.
Right.
They feel as though they are in danger in the story, but safe in your hands, which is really, because my... because both projects I'm discussing are horror novels, and I have also found that very challenging. Some of the stuff that I have come face to face with out of my own mouth and words has been confronting, but I hope that I do a good enough job with the craft of the rest of it that the reader trusts me, even if they're afraid of the monster. And that's such a, this again, it's about hoping that the reader can live in that space between you, who's their guide as an author, and the characters and the creatures and the monsters and the bad vibes that are in the fiction. So they're sort of walking between a space, I think, a little bit, you know?
Yeah, that trust is an interesting word, because I don't want them to trust me to take care of them.
No.
I want them to trust me to have it be worth
the journey, yeah.
Worthwhile, or like have some effect that is like, that matters and that's meaningful, you know. I don't need them to feel good at all. Certainly.
Do you know, I didn't feel that for a long time, and I wrote the two projects that I'm talking around constantly.
Yeah.
Had really fucking bad vibe endings.
Yeah.
And I, or non-endings, but where everything was left was bad vibes. And I started to think, I read a brilliant book called Now She's a Witch by Kirsty Logan. And it's set in the 15th century, and it's about witches, kind of, it's absolutely stunning work and very scary for lots of reasons. And I was so astonished by the ending of it that somehow she had pulled this really taut ribbon of hope.
Yeah.
And I think that taught me something in that moment. That hope, it doesn't have to all be better. You know, like, does a character get what they want, need, and deserve? You know, are you resolving everything, blah, blah, blah. But if you've brought them all this way and shown them all of these things from the inside of yourself, like, for what? And I think on a sort of a human level, it doesn't necessarily have to be light piercing the darkness or restorative or, or healing or holistic. Like, no, no, no. I just think a little beam of hope is what I go to books for, generally. Even if I go in to be terrified on purpose, if I go in to freak myself out, I go to different stories and different books for different things all the time. But I know that I always feel like it was worth it.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I've toyed with that. And, like, Grant Morrison writes about that because, and Colin Wilson, too, they're just like, what we do actually changes reality. So you need to put, like, this, there has to be some of that in there. And I think in some ways I agree, but then I also think the hope that you get is that you're not in this, like, that you're holding it.
The campfire gets blown out and the story, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like you you get to live in fear and like sorrow and desperation, but you're not in this
on purpose.
In the same way that when you have a nightmare and you wake up, like, that dream will stay with you for the whole day, but you get to, you know, flick the light off and on of like, but that wasn't me. That wasn't me. That wasn't me. And I think that contraction and expansion can actually lead you to a place of development in a way that reading it in the story is not necessarily going to give it to you. And, you know, that said, like, a lot of times when writers go for that, I think they fail. Like, when writers try to create, I'm thinking of a novel I recently read, which is, I'll tell you what it is after we're done, but it's one of the most like violent, gory, hopeless books I've ever read. And it just wasn't good enough. Like, it was almost kind of like when you watch Kill Bill and there's so much violence in it that none of it registers as violence anymore.
I'm so quick to turn back. It's funny. As a horror lady, I have such a weird sensitive dial with violence. Sometimes I'm like, this is perfectly fine. And other times I'm like, nope, cheap. Like, I don't know where it comes from or why it comes from there. It is completely unpredictable.
Maybe like a sommelier or something like that. You know the flavors of it.
Yeah. Sometimes it's unearned. Sometimes it's cheap. Sometimes it's I'm not out here listing, naming and shaming, but I have a really, really finely tuned sensor bar.
Yeah.
But that's, again, it's subjective. Do you know what I mean? It's just where I am.
Yeah.
With it, you know?
No, but I think, knowing some of the stuff that you like and that we've talked about, I don't think it's unrefined. I think it's like actually well developed. But I'm just thinking like of those times when I'm like, you just actually, you think that you've been excessive and you've gone overboard, but actually you've failed because you've not gone far enough in a way. Mm-hmm. Like you've covered up the violence by just putting too much violence in, or you've covered up the terror by making it too graphic. And what I actually want you to do is brutalize me more than you've done, not less. You think you're doing more, but I need you to do even more than this. And so sometimes, like, I just want, you know, like Rosemary's Baby, for instance, is just one of my favorite.
Do you know, I watched
movies.
That on a plane recently.
You did?
And Gary was like, are you fucking watching, are you watching Rosemary's Baby?
Yeah.
Like, we're flying to the States. And I was like, yeah, why not? And he's like, there's people around. I was like, good. I'd never seen it before. And I thought, well, this is the best way to watch it. Woof.
Yeah. I mean, no way out, right? Like, I mean, then it's just fucking brutal.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Like, start to finish. And
we saw you across the apartment complex and we like your vibe.
It's just good old fashioned Lipton's tea. You'll drink it. But I love that movie, and I seek that sensation of being really, really like confronted, almost assaulted by the art. There's a Nicholas Winding Refn series that he wrote with Ed Brubaker called Too Old to Die Young. I think there are only like 9 episodes and was on Amazon. For some reason, it just like kind of fell through the cracks. I think probably pandemic stuff. It's incredible, and it is absolutely brutal. And so, you know, some Patricia Highsmith stories are absolutely brutal. But to your point before, where you were saying, you know, you're writing it and it starts to like take over, or like, you know, it becomes really difficult to, you know, live there too much without feeling like, oh, I'm a coal miner or something like that. I think like the opposite also is true, but the other side of that is true, where people often, you know, when they want to be writers, they live out the kinds of lives that they actually want to be writing about. So like I work with a lot of writers. So, you know, a lot of times people want to write these really dramatic things, and then like they'll show up and they'll be like, oh, I didn't write because this crazy thing happened to me and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, you just want to put that in your writing. Or like, I used to say, when I had a therapist who asked me what my model of love was, and I was like, this is a crazy thing to say. I was like, it's kind of like, you know, if you're like holding on to someone and you're like falling off a train trestle, but you're both falling to your doom and holding each other. And she was like, what? And I was like, yeah, it'd be really great to write about that kind of stuff instead of living it, though. Yeah, like, yeah. To like having that. So
I think it's monastic. I feel like I literally live like I'm such a monastic life, and I haven't got the time to have a dramatic life. Do you know what I mean? I wouldn't be able to write if I had a dramatic life.
But you do
life.
Have a dramatic life. That's the funny life. Thing.
I do find myself in. Yeah.
Or you create stories that like elicit the drama.
It's all in the conference as well, and how you discuss your life. That Oscar Wilde thing. Do you know what I mean? Of like, I could have a very basic interaction and be like, wait until I tell you about these women that I met at Aqua Aerobics.
But that's like, that's just Irish, you know, too. What's
definitely
the, like,
possessed by some Shanachie spirit, you know what I mean? Turning incredibly basic things into incredibly elaborate stories. Because that is it. It all just comes down to story, you know? And like, being a storyteller and being a writer are both the same thing and different things.
Different, yeah.
And that is really, really important too. You know, part of not being able to talk about what I've been working on for a couple of years has forced me to not tell the story of what I am writing, which means I don't puncture it or I don't leave it in the air to oxidize. Like, you can talk a book or an idea 100%. To death, you know?
Yeah.
And you might get a hit of satisfaction from saying, here's exactly what my novel is about, beep, borp, beep, borp, beep, borp. And then you've said it and it's lost some of its luster for having been brought out, and that's the price of holding it in.
It
remains vivid for the want of exposure.
Well, it's not subjected to other people's like elemental beings, like they're not like adding their own fairies to it, you know. So interesting that, the storytelling and writing thing, that's a distinction that would actually get rid of a lot of really bad Irish novels if people understood the difference here. Because I find actually, I mean, there's all kinds of, we can talk about American novels, but just as an outsider, something that I see in a lot of like Irish novels and fiction that I think is not so great is a lot of like stylish sentences that are really just about fucking nothing worth saying. So like there's tons and tons of like books about like two lads having cans, you know, and like just overwrought like sentences about those kinds of things. I think it's a great thing to hear someone tell you when you're sitting next to them at the pub, or you're over at your, you know, partner's family house or something like that, and you're hearing these stories and they're told in this dramatic tone. It's fucking great. And it's like, I will sit happily and listen to someone tell me that. But when it just gets put on the page, it's not living up to the different kinds of responsibilities that it has there. And I think people think that's just like, oh, this must be like John Banville or something like that, because he'll do these really like dramatic sentences, but he's like a master at it. It's like, you can't just pull that off because you're a storyteller. You have to be a writer, and those are two different things. You're right.
This is it. It's a job that is composed of, capital J, like a job, work that is composed of, you do have to be able to tell a story. Mm-hmm. You do have to be able to write. You do have to be able to engage with the industry, capital I, of publishing, capital P. You have to, so ultimately it's so many different things at once. But in the same way that if I had a job as a florist, I would have to be able to do a lot of different things as well. Yeah. Being good at flower arrangements doesn't mean you're a good florist. Knowing what different flowers are called doesn't mean that you're a good florist. Like, there are so many strange facets and secrets of that that I got to witness from just a little bit beyond the veil. And I think that any trade, carpenters, like anyone who makes things in the world, like, has to have style, but they also have to have structure, and they also have to have knowledge of the industry, and they also oftentimes have to have that weird little ephemeral storyteller, whatever the equivalent of that thing is. You have to have that too. I think that kind of resides in everyone somewhere, but you have to have access to it and be able to channel it. So I think, like, there are some people who are cracking storytellers who maybe don't even want to write because they have to do all the lonely stuff, you know? Mm. And there are some people who love doing the lonely stuff but can't really wrap it all around a story. Making yourself able to do all of those things and access all of those things is the work. Some parts of it will be easy. Some parts of it will flow like water. You might just be a really good business person who knows the language of PR and publicity and is able to do all that stuff. You might be able to do, you might not be able to do all of it really well. I'm definitely not. I know where my weaknesses are, I think, and I'm sure I'm going to be surprised by more of them. Like, being an all-rounder is really tough, and there definitely are all-rounders, you know? And yeah, I don't know. I feel like I could kind of keep circling that, but I think, yeah, I think you kind of got to have a bit of that storyteller magic, but you can't let it be, you can't rely on it. And I know this because, like, I am that person in the pub telling everyone about the ladies in the sauna. I'm so excited to tell you about the thing about the dog that they told me. Like, I've had this story of me sitting in the sauna with these ladies a couple of weeks ago, and the way they were talking rattling around my head. And I'm like, that's not a book. That's not even a paragraph, Sarah. That is just a story that you are going to be throwing out over dinner tables for the rest of your life. It's a jewel, but it's not the mine or the mining.
I love how you're saying all that. And, you know, when you think about someone telling a story and, like, yes, their audience is right in front of them, so already things are completely different than when you're writing. But I do think that there's that bit there where every time you're about to write, you should have the kind of hidden storyteller line before you begin, which is like, listen, I've got to tell you a story about something, you know, and then you begin, but you begin differently. It's not like I was walking down the road the other one day and I saw this and this and this. Well, actually it could be if you're a first person narrator, but you see, it's like, they're all ways in, you know, all different ways in. And I love that you're talking about just all these threads that are, you know, coming in and you have to really weave together. This loom is very strange. It's just very strange. And, you know, I think a lot of things we said, also a lot of other writers would hear us talking about this and be like, no, completely wrong.
Oh my God, completely
different
wrong.
Universe.
Completely different. It's so subjective in the way that no two people are truly, you know, the same. No two writers are truly the same. And also, not everyone comes to the job wanting the same thing.
Yeah, that's
like,
right.
Literally, not everybody wants the same thing. Like, I think you and I, as horror writers, we are coming from totally different places towards a similar, towards, in fact, the same shelf on the bookstore, bookstore, G and H not being too far away from each other. The same ghetto horror, like end of the bookstore where they put all the genre writers, you know?
Where the cool
and
kids
like,
are.
Yeah, down the back with the lads. But like, I do think that you have to account for how everyone is, like, when I talk to my friends who work in England, for example, like, and they have such a different vibe about it. But ultimately, when you strip it back and you get into talking about the work, that little fire is the same. So I think that there's so many unifying factors in an industry and in a vocation, I think is what we're talking about ultimately, that just differs so strongly from person to person. Like, there's loads of things that I do not want, and I know I do not want. And I think that if I can feel enough of those out, it allows me to make more room in myself and in my imagination and in my palpable grown-up career goals. Like, if I try to think too hard about what it means to be a writer and work as a writer in the world and generalize myself, I can't listen to the kind of really really pointed guiding light that I have. You know?
Yeah, I understand. It's like the fairies, you know, have a harder time living where there's electricity and where there's, you know, a power grid and all that kind of stuff, because there are other beings that live in the electricity and the power grid that kind of crowd them out. It's like there's an ecosystem of life, and you don't want to imbalance it. And I'm very excited to read your next two books, which will be out at a certain date, coming soon.
Coming soon. Sooner than you think.
They just sound excellent, and I just always love talking with you. I'm so happy to have you back on the show, Sarah Marie Griffin.
Thank you so much, Connor. I really appreciate it. I feel like we exited the world and went into somewhere very quiet and very good for a while. So thank you for having me. Let's just hope we don't knock all the lights out on the block this time.
All right. And thank you, everybody, so much for listening. Bye now.